Erev Tov, everybody. Hope everybody is doing well. As today we kicked off this morning the summer series of Torah Motion Online, our summer series. We hope to have a lot of opportunities to learn with you, and we encourage you to invite your friends, other people to join. Anything you've missed, we have recordings. We've started now putting up some of these talks on YouTube, so if people want to watch them on video, that's also afterwards. And like always, we're interested to hear your feedback, comments, and suggestions. Of course, you know, Dr. Mark has been doing these classes for, I don't know, 12 years or something. As I've mentioned before, we have over 200 of his talks. They're very well worth listening to on a range of so many people just now with, you know, the turn of events in the world. So it's picked up a little bit different, but I do encourage you to listen to all the previous talks and the over 1,000 other talks we have online. Those who were here last week know that Dr. Shapiro ended the class by saying next week he'll talk on Dr. Lamb. His correspondence, Dr. Lamb. Little, of course, did we know that the Dr. Lamb would, you know, pass away yesterday. He was really, I don't know how many people here knew him personally. He was, of course, the president of Yeshiva University when I was a student there. He was really a tremendous, tremendous leader, really one of the builders and molders of modern centrist orthodoxy, whatever you want to talk about, a phenomenal orator, a great communal rabbi, a scholar, academic scholar, a Talmud Chacham, you know, somebody who really pushed what he believed in. He spoke firmly for it, and an amazing fundraiser. He raised basically $2 billion for Yeshiva University. He saved it from Chapter 11, which was the fate they were going, and that he really will be missed, and whatever. So it just turns in, and we are dedicating this evening's talk to his memory. Okay, Dr. Shapiro, it's all yours.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Kelman. And yes, we have a lot to say, but as always, before I do that, we've been getting now with the YouTube even more people and a number of comments sent to me. So let me just take 2 minutes or 3 minutes and then we'll move on, obviously, back to the book, deal with Dr. Lamb. I don't know if the person we spoke a little bit about Dikduk last week is on there, but I did want to clarify that when we spoke about this third type of Shiva, it's not because not only because the words like darchei, which is plural already, derachim, but what about, for example, etchem? You'd expect it to be etchem, or the word we have in Migilas Esther, sharvit. Why not sharbit? Or we say in Shema, lavdo b'chol avavchem. There's no dagation to dalit. So it's in order to explain that there is this theory of a second shiva. Incidentally, we have one example, as far as I know, only one example where after the movable shva, the shva na, you have a dagesh, and that is the word shite, two. And we think that dagesh is because a nun dropped. David Eisen, a longtime listener for many, many years, sometimes he's with us even in Israel live, so he gets an award for that. Regarding my leaving my tefillin, remember the very first class when I went to, I spoke about how I went to Ethiopia and I left my, the question was leaving my tefillin. In fact, I also said that I went with the great Ari Zivotofsky. Here, incidentally, you can see on the way there, we stopped in Egypt. There you can see on the right, that's Rabbi Dr. Ari Zivotofsky. I'll mention him a little bit again later today. In the middle is my brother, and that is me right there. So this takes us back to 1987. David sent me Shlomo Carlbach, has the book about Shlomo Carlbach called Holy Brother, and he tells the same story I told, how when he was in Russia, a Jewish boy who was going to be bar mitzvah, he begged him for his tefillin. And Shlomo gave him the tefillin, because how could he not give him his tefillin? And then he asked him for his yarmulke, and he gave him his yarmulke. Okay, in terms of shuckling, I don't want to get into it. There's a lot you could say. Those who are interested, please, you can read this book by Louis Jacobs, Hasidic Prayer. He has a whole chapter on it. He goes through everything. Incidentally, I didn't mention last week that the Ramah himself mentions in Simon Memchet 48, that the Medaktikim would shuckle. In the Kuzari that I mentioned also, you can find it in book two, I think it is chapter 80. He mentions shuckling in learning. That's because he said there's only one book for a group of people, and you have to go like this to see the book. What I do want to add, though, and many of you sent me material, I could give you a lot of that. I do want to read you something, though.
I sent it out.
Posted on a blog post a long time ago. Let me just read it in Hebrew and tell you what it is about why shuckling. This is from a Hasidic text, Likutei Ikarim. Those who know Hebrew, you'll get it. Those who don't know Hebrew, I'll sort of summarize it. Hatfila hi zivug im hashchina, ukemo shebatchilat hazivug yeshna nua, kein sarich nanea atzmo betfila. Basically, he's comparing davening to sexual relations, and I don't need to go any further, and that's why they're shuckling. It's a classic Hasidic text, Likutei Ikarim. And finally, the last two more things. Thank you to Mel. I think Mel is correct when I said that in YU in the 50s and 60s, they used to go to Ramosha, Rav Henkin, for questions. Really, by the 60s, it was Ramosha. Also, Mel pointed out to me that Ari Zivotofsky, the great Ari Zivotofsky, has a whole article, What's the Truth About Gal Yisrael? We mentioned that last class. He gives all the shitas. And what it comes down to is, Avid Kamar, Avid. Whatever you do, you're okay. But most say that Chazan should say out loud, but some say it's okay to say it quietly. One of you mentioned this book, and Rabbi Polyakov's daughter was on with us last week, Minhag Elita. And yes, you will find it on page 21, where he says that the Chazan must say it out loud. That's a very interesting book. I spoke a little bit last week. I just was glancing through it, and you know he's a real stark Litvak, because on page 68, he talks about how it's idolatry to do the upsharing, and that no good Lithuanian Jew would ever do that. But I asked my friend in Lakewood, he says, other than the real Litvakim, everyone in the yeshiva world, even the Litvaks, now do the upsharing. So if you want to see Rabbi Polyakov, page 68, you get the famous story with the Brisker Rav. Some guy brought his son to the Brisker Rav to cut his hair on his third birthday, and the Brisker Rav said, I don't cut hair, I'm not a barber. But even the modern Orthodox have gotten into it. It's a real party. And finally, the last thing, Hyman Schaffer. Okay, Hyman pointed out something which I knew and I wasn't sure. I didn't say it, and now you'll have to judge for yourself. Remember, I've been saying all this, how the book we're going to start looking at in 1 minute is the third Sefer ever published with Catholic money, and the first two were the Kisvei Rabbi Chaya Yaakov Weinberg. There is another one, but I wasn't sure if it's like a traditional Sefer. And I've mentioned this before at other occasions, and it was published by Paulist Press. I'll see if anyone gets it and can put it in. Paulist Press, I'm just reading about it. It's published by the Paulist Fathers, missionary priests, et cetera, et cetera. Rav Soloveitchik's Al HaTshuva. Yes, Chaya Marx has it. The English version by Pinchas Pelli was published by Paulus Press. So why didn't I mention that? I didn't mention it because it's English. You know, it's a safer in English. I guess today, a lot of Sfarim are like Bleich's books. I remember, you know, some guy writing about how they're the most important Sfarim in our time. He's obviously a halachocentric guy who said that. But would anyone deny that they're Sfarim? So I guess, but that means they're of Soloveitchik's Al HaTshuva, as far as I know, in English, is the first safer ever published by Catholics. And maybe so, because, you know, On Lonely Man of Faith was first delivered at a Catholic seminary in Brighton, Massachusetts, if you can believe this. So I'm happy. If I have to give up the glory to anyone, it best be to me, Rabbi Soloveitchik. I guess Al HaTshuva in English is a sefer. Maybe. I mean, it's a translation of a sefer. But okay, so now we move. We begin again, continuing with Igros Malchei Rabbanan, the book I published, the letters. One of you was so impatient, you said, well, what are you going to do after this? So this is going to take us many weeks, but if we're still inside and we can't go out, I can start doing the Kisvei Rabbi Chaya Yaakov Weinberg, Volume 1 Halacha, Volume 2 on Hashkafa. Oh, the history of the Gedolim, and we'll be here for another few years. And as Rabbi Kelman said last week, the next Simon 13, Yud Gimel, is my correspondence with Rabbi Lamb. So I was going to tell you, of course, as I always did, I didn't think I need to tell you really about who Rabbi Lamb was, but I will now, in light of the events. You know, his wife also just passed away about a month ago, and he was preceded by a daughter, unfortunately. So I was going to tell you what led me to him, our connection, and the question, because it's a very interesting question. But since you know, of his passing, and there's a lot been written about him, you can go online. Why you sent out something tomorrow, they're having the eulogy, and Rav Schechter is also speaking, and I'm very curious to hear that, because he at times was at odds with Rabbi Lam, Dr. Lam, in terms of the direction of the yeshiva. So well, it'll be interesting to see that. And so let me just say a little bit about Dr. Lam that you might not know, not the standard things. And he's born in 1927. He went to Torah Vadas. So I don't know if you're aware of this, but Torah Vadas, which was originally founded by, I'll show you something in a minute. Founded by leaders, including from the Mizrahi, Zev Gold, and others, they have a website. Yeshiva Torah Vadas has a website. Here's a Haredi yeshiva with a website. And on the website, it has a list of yearbooks. Every yearbook that they have, they don't have Dr. Lamb's, because his, I believe, would be in 1944. It goes 43 to 45. And then they, it ends like 78. I think that's the last one when they stopped doing a yearbook, I guess. But if you look through it, it's incredible, because you see so many great people, so many people who made a mark. And it wasn't Haredi yeshiva like we think of today. I've downloaded all the yearbooks, because I have a feeling maybe they're going to be taken off. Let me give you an example. So because you think of Dr. Lam and you say, oh, he went to Torah Vadas. So many people went to Torah Vadas. Let me just show you just one page, which someone sent me. I found other interesting stuff, but I was looking for great names of rabbis and other leaders. I wasn't reading like this, but someone else sent me this. I want to show you, just to give you an example of the page. This is from the yearbook, one of the yearbooks. It's from 1941. Take a look at the guy on top, Irving Dropkin. Maybe some of you know him. If he's alive, I hope so. Absolutely free of all conceit. As an athlete, Chink is hard to beat. As a Don Juan, well, let's not debate. Just ask the girls who live in Seagate. So you get a sense. Now, am I saying that the rabbis were happy with this? Of course not. They're probably furious. But if we did something like that at JC, when I went to high school, they also would be furious, the rabbis. What it says is, though, it shows you about the students. That the students, this is what they were like. Today, the students of Torah Vadas wouldn't dream of anything like that. I mean, talk about girls or anything. So clearly, it's a different sort of yeshiva, and there's probably many of you who remember. It was more to the right, of course, than YU, but the students going came from all sorts of backgrounds. And when you say it was more to the right of YU, yeah, it was. But let me show you some other things which come from Torah Vadas. Hold on a second. This is from Torah Vadas. They sent out after the State of Israel was formed a special Haggadah. And look at the picture here of Israel, the pioneers. Here's another one. This is right in the Haggadah. And look at this. Hold on to your seats. Look how the women are dressed. And this is sent out by Torah Vadas. In fact, I have to tell you that this book was just appeared. See this big thick one here? It's called America's Yeshiva. Not Yisus Elchanan, Torah Vadas, 1919. Okay, look how thick it is. It's a whole beautiful picture book. The pictures are unbelievable. All about Torah Vadas, about the time when Dr. Lam was there. I don't think he's mentioned at all in the book, but all sorts of other people mentioned. They tell the truth that about Zev Gold, the leader of the Mizrahi, signer of the Israel Declaration of Independence, how he was involved very much in founding the yeshiva. That isn't the case, by the way, in the, if you look in the video they put out, they don't mention Zev Gold at all. But it's in here so much. I believe that this book, this great big book, was written by a few different people, because although the first half of the book has all the history, including the march, there's a big march of the yeshiva, and they're holding the Zionist flag in the march. When you get to the end, things are a little different, because they talk about the new Rosh Yeshivas they have, and they go through every Rosh Yeshiva, discuss them, Rav Palm, Rav Gedalia Shur, Rav Kamenetsky, then they get to the more modern ones. And two of the modern Rosh Yeshiva, by the way, are the two ones today. One's named Rav Yosef Savitsky, and the other is Rav Yitzhak Lichtenstein, who was appointed a few years ago. So it's interesting because Rav Mordechai Savitsky and Rav Soloveitchik did not get along very well. They were actually at odds with each other in the early years. In fact, during the Kashrus controversy, where Savitsky was on the other side. Later on, they did get together, but in the early years, not. So now the sentence of ceremony is Rosh Shiv. But let me read you what it says on towards the end about Rav Yitzhak Lichtenstein. Rav Yitzhak Lichtenstein, a descendant of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and a grandson through marriage of Rav Reuven Grozovsky, you know, he came to lead the yeshiva. So no mention of the father and no mention of the grandfather. And it's not like Yitzhak Lichtenstein has gone off to the Haredi side and forgot his roots. He actually published his grandfather's Haggadah and other works of his grandfather. And it's like, who are they trying to fool? Everyone knows who his father is and everyone knows who his grandfather is. So it's not like it's a cover-up like usually you see in Haredi literature where they don't want you to know about it. They know that everyone reading it knows about it. And so that was disappointing. But it's a different era. The school that Dr. Lamb goes to and where he gets his early Torah, although he got a lot of Torah, of course, also maybe more from his family. He has an uncle and a grandfather in particular. He's an uncle who's a Mechaber Sefer, Baumo, and a grandfather of Yeshua Baumo, the author of the Emek Halacha. He was an important Rav in New York, also related to Torah Vadas, because Torah Vadas had this problem in the early years of the yeshiva. You had these guys called the Malachim. These were like religious fanatics who started dressing in all black, long coats and wearing tzitzis out. Today, maybe one seemed fanatical, growing beards, that sort of stuff. And Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelwitz wanted to throw them out of the yeshiva. They weren't following the rules. And he writes to Rabbi Baumel, and you could look it up. It's volume 2, number 28. And you can read about how Rabbi Baumel writes to him, Halacha Maisa, that you can, the tshuva is about one person in particular, but we know it's about all of them. Throw them out, and they were thrown out. Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelwitz threw them out of the yeshiva, and that's Rabbi Lamb's grandfather. After finishing, of course, you have to go to college. Everyone went to college in those days. This is before the Lakewood Revolution. So the question was, do you go to Brooklyn College, Queens College? Do you go full-time? Do you go at night? Do you go to Columbia? Do you go to YU? And he went to YU, and he got smicha at YU, and then he becomes a rabbi in Springfield, Massachusetts, the home of the Basketball Hall of Fame. There used to be a number of shuls. They've all now combined, Orthodox shuls. But his shul was Congregation Kadima, where he comes in 53, or 50, end of 53, I think, Rosh Hashanah. He took over for another rabbi who had just finished up about 18 years, Isaac Klein. Isaac Klein, Yeshiva College graduate, started at Yeshiva Sirvitz Ochanan and switched to the seminary. Isaac Klein, one of the three people to get personal smicha from Louis Ginsberg. The others were Louis Finkelstein and Boaz Cohen, the author of the conservative code of Jewish law. It's like a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch in English. And if you took out the stuff dealing with cheese and wine, any Orthodox Jew would have no problem using it. But he was the rabbi of the Orthodox shul there. Lamb was there only a few years, actually before, and when he was a YU, right before he went there, he was assistant rabbi, I should say, at KJ. He'd soon go to the Jewish Center, just like Mordechai Kaplan was at the KJ and then found the Jewish Center. But he comes back to New York City in 59. He had thought, incidentally, of going on to a career in the sciences. He was a chemistry major, but he was convinced to devote his time to Torah. And he starts teaching at YU Jewish philosophy, but he doesn't have an advanced degree. It's then he starts working on his dissertation. He has the distinction, Dr. Lamb, of the only PhD ever directed by Rabbi Soloveitchik. And this was it came out in Hebrew and then in English in the 80s. It came out in Hebrew earlier on Rav Chaim of Luzhin. So he has smicha, and he was obviously very close to the Rav. He wrote it on Rav Chaim Volozhin, something very close to the Rav's heart, the idea of Torah Lishma. At this time, he's working as the Jewish Center. He's the rabbi there, and he was there for many, many years. Not that many years, a decade. Then he's chosen to become president of YU. What's significant about his time there is that, a number of things. First, he starts tradition, the journal. That still continues. He He was very influential in the Upper West Side. Of course, that was it's a center of Jewish money, Orthodox money, and community. And he was a great orator. We heard it from Rabbi Kelman. Very unusual. He wrote out every one of his sermons, word for word. You can go on the YU website, the archives, and you could see all his sermons. They uploaded all of them. And he dealt with all the issues under the sun. And you see him saying things which today might seem, he wouldn't maybe say them today because he's talking about, you know, maybe there will be rabbis for women rabbis in the future. You know, I'm not going to opine on it, but he's not like saying absolutely not. And you find, well, someone wrote me today asking, he was looking at the sermons and Rabbi Lamb in 19, I think he said it was in 65 or 64, is 65, I think he said, he is writing about how we have to, you know, stress the mitzvah of matanos, of mishloach manot. He says it's a mace mitzvah. He says, no one does mishloach manot. And the person asked me, and I didn't know this either. He goes, "That's I guess on the Upper West Side in the 60s, people weren't doing mishloach manot. There wasn't, you have to ask people who lived during that time, but that he gives a whole sermon on it. So at least in his show, people were not following that. A great orator. He writes scholarship during his time. He writes Torah during his time, and he makes himself a reputation as one of the leaders of American Orthodoxy, American, you know, born and bred, someone who's able to speak about the problems of the day, everything from the sexual revolution to the homosexuality. He writes the first article on halacha and homosexuality, presents a possible solution, treating homosexuals as ones, that they really are sort of like forced into doing what they're doing. So maybe we can judge them not the way the harsh judgments of the Talmud. Really very important. In one of his early articles, he publishes in the Jewish Quarterly Review, he was Zocha, at least he thought he was Zocha, for a very harsh response by the great Harry Wolfson, the premier scholar of Jewish philosophy. And I asked Dr. Lamb once, because here he's a young scholar, rabbi academic, and he publishes this, and the leading authority in the world on Jewish philosophy blows him away. So I asked him, like, how'd you feel? Were you embarrassed? He says, no, I felt a lot of pride. The fact that Harry Wolfson thought it was worth his time to write a whole essay to show why I was wrong, it's like what people said with the Rav Shear. If the Rav called on you and then said you're an Amaretz or anything, you don't feel embarrassed. You feel good that at least he thought that your idea was worth criticizing rather than just ignoring you. And I've heard the same thing of people who are in Lieberman's class as well. He becomes president of YU, as Rabbi Kelman mentioned, the school was in very difficult circumstances. Lamb was preceded by two important presidents, Iluyim, unbelievable, big Talmidei Chachamim, Revel, Bernard Revel, and Samuel Belkin. Samuel Belkin was from the Chafetz Chaim, who also became great scholars, academic scholars, but they never really published anything. Belkin's great work on Philo was only after his death it came out. He published his one book, which is his dissertation. The same with Revel. You know, running a university, you know, raising money, that's the main job. Waiting enough time to write. This is going to be Lamb's unbelievable achievement. Even though he becomes president, when Belkin had almost bankrupted the university. For all of his wonderful achievements and what he built, he was a great builder. He almost bankrupted it. Lamb was able to rebuild. Raise enormous amounts of money. I asked him once, how did you raise money? I can see you raise money. It's a full-time job for the university. You have to raise money for a medical school, for a law school. How do you? And he explained that, you know, each different people you go, you raise it differently. And yet throughout all that, most people, academics, they become deans, they become presidents. You kiss academic scholarship goodbye. When do you have the time? Certainly president of the university. They give you a fancy place in New York. You're supposed to have meetings every night. You're having your meeting. When do you have time to write? I don't know how he did it. I could say the same thing about Jonathan Sacks. I don't know how he did it either. But Norman Lamb was able to continuously write throughout his time as president. And let me just say, and that's going to get to the point where we could talk about our correspondence. Just a couple other things. He presided over an era where yeshiva university growth. On the other hand, many people will historically look and say it was under his time that the school went to the right. And they'll blame him for that. I don't know if you can, if you think it's a good thing, then, get the credit. But many people in the modern Orthodox world are unhappy with the direction of YU. You know, that's the world, though. The world was moving to the right. Lamb, I don't think he ever changed. He did say that we don't need the term modern Orthodox. He wanted centrist. But I don't think he ever changed. The leading Rosh Yeshiva, more on the right. Had Rav Lichtenstein remained in America instead of blaming this on Norman Lamb, you can blame Rivarim Lichtenstein, as certain people have, that he abandoned America. Had he remained in America, he would have been the real successor of the Rav. So I don't think that's a criticism of Norman Lamb. Norman Lamb remained Rosh, he was also a Rosh Yeshiva, and he was able to be a Rosh Yeshiva. This is what we have to remember. The first three presidents of YU were also, I'm not going to say that Lamb was a Talmud Chacham like Belkin or a Revel, but he certainly was a fine Talmud Chacham, one who could give a shiur, who did give a shiur to the university. He published halachic articles. He published a whole sefer. He was a really a Renaissance man, Ish Eshkolot, and of course he did what Belkin and Revel did not do: not only write on scholarship, be a spokesman for modern Orthodoxy, confronting the issues of the day, whatever the issues are, be it as I said, sexual ethics, be it politics, situation in Israel, in a way that his predecessors did not. He was appointed president. Unfortunately, we don't have the story of that. But we have a book about YU by Jeffrey Gurak. And yet the whole thing is glossed over. He becomes president. And yet we know that that was a serious election with strongly held feelings. Now, why didn't Gurak write about this? I never really asked him. You can ask him, I'm sure it's being Riverdale. The fact that he was Lamb's academic assistant when he wrote it, in addition to being the professor in the of American Jewish history at YU, might be the reason. I don't know, but I don't see how you could write a book on YU and not talk about the presidency, where you had two leading figures. You had Emanuel Rachman, also a major figure in modern Orthodoxy at the time, who was very much involved with Yeshiva University. He was Belkin's right-hand man. In fact, I don't believe it, but Rachman told me that the Rav was on his side. The reason I don't believe it is because Chaim Soloveitchik is known to have gone into the board meeting and started reading things from Rachman's writings and says, we can't have him as president. And there must be minutes somewhere of the meetings to find out. Maury Weiss, I believe, was involved with this through his father-in-law, I guess. I don't know if he himself was at the meetings, but this became a big conflict. Is it going to be Rachman, who had many important backers, or Lamb? Had Rachman been appointed, the university would have probably gone to the left, certainly wouldn't have gone to the right. Lamb was appointed. Again, I don't know the inner politics. All we know are the rumors and everything. So Rachman then feels he has to leave. He goes to Israel and becomes the chancellor of Bar-Ilan University. So it's one of those great what ifs if Rachman had become president. So let me leave it at that and just say that in terms of his scholarship, he wrote a very important book. And here it is. It's called The Encounter of Religious Learning and Worldly Knowledge in the Jewish Tradition. Many of you are YU graduates, so you know this, but for those who aren't, you should know that the term Torah Umada, Torah and science, really Torah, and it's understood Mada in a larger sense of Western civilization. I don't know why they picked the word Mada, but maybe because scientific Judaism, that's the slogan, the motto of YU. And it's always been a problematic slogan because on the one hand, the administration always advocates it, and the presidents have always advocated it. You can even go back to Revel. Look in Rakefet's biography, which has his addresses at the graduations, and you can see Revel always pushing this. But we know that the Rosh Yeshiva often were completely opposed to it. The Rav, of course, was not. The Rav was the biggest backer of at least secular studies at the university. I'm not saying he believed in the ideology of the synthesis we're going to see, which he did not. There never was actually a book-length exposition. Why you used to have this thing called the Torah Mata Reader, which had an essay from Rivarim Lichtenstein and some other stuff that he would pass out to all freshmen. Norman Lamb decided he was going to actually write a book explaining the philosophy of Torah Umada. It's copyright 1990. And if you look at the preface of the book, he writes how he began prepare the, how, you know, he, how did he write the book? He says that he began to prepare it in Jerusalem in the home of Hermann and Ursula Merkin. It's an important German Orthodox family, became big backers of Yeshiva University. The Merkins are, if you want to learn about them, maybe not such good stuff, you can read about Daphne Merkin, what she has to say about them in her memoir. But this is the Breuer family. Hermann Merkin's wife is the sister of Isaac Breuer, that makes the granddaughter of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. Which is significant because the Hirschians in Washington Heights treated YU like it was in Hiram. They wanted nothing to do with it. Daphne Merkin, you can read what she has to say. But, I'd encourage you not to, actually, but if you want to. And then he says, the month of quiet contemplation in the lovely surroundings of Yarnton Manor in England as the guest of the Oxford Hebrew Studies Center. And then it goes on, the competent and loyal assistance of my academic assistant, Professor Jeffrey F. Gurak, etc. Okay, that's where I come in. Because I was a... Lamb tells us that he went to Oxford for a month. He was given, I guess, a sabbatical of a month, and he could go there, and he used to go up in the summer to Camp Morashah. Those of you who went to Morashah, you might remember, but to work on this book. In fact, he gave in Oxford, he gave a whole lecture on it. Yarnton Manor was a place that was owned by the Oxford Hebrew Center. Center for Hebrew and Judaic Studies, and it was they sold it about 7 years ago. It was a manor with like 10 different houses on it, and a library and places to eat. You're there, you feel like you're a nobility for old, and that's what it was. It was an old manor from the nobility, and that was owned by the Oxford Hebrew Center. And I was in Oxford at the Oxford Hebrew Center in 1987 to 88. And that's, the book is published in 90, but that was the year. And Norman Lamb came during my time there. It was a great time there. Incidentally, before I go on, I just want to say one more thing. We heard today, this morning, and I encourage everyone to listen to Dov Zakheim. It's on YouTube now. After Norman Lamb left the presidency when he retired, they offered the job to Dov Zakheim. Actually, I mean, they voted. It was an official offer. It was his for the taking. And he chose not to take it for a variety of reasons. And then they decided to go to Richard Job. So getting, I think I remember that because I think, if I'm not mistaken, Dov Zakheim also studied in Oxford. But so getting back to the story, so I was in Oxford for, yes, he was in Oxford also, Dov Zakheim. But many, many interesting people were there. It was a, they would pass through Yarnton. They'd go come for a week, 2 weeks, a month. Yitzhak Gilat was there when I was there. Michal Schwartz, the great scholar. Let me get a picture up here for you for him. The great scholar of a Jewish philosophy who retranslated the Rambam. Here, I'll show you a picture of him here. Picture for you. Eliezer Don Yechiel. Many, many people were there. Here's a picture of Michal Schwartz. He translated the Mor Nevuchim from Arabic into, he died a few years ago, Arabic into Hebrew. This is now the standard edition. I remember I brought him to the Chabad to eat. I saw him once in the... there was a restaurant. Today, I don't think we would do that, but there was a vegan restaurant there, which we all would eat at. By the way, in terms of, there's a letter which is not in the book. We'll get, after we finish the book, we'll deal with the letters that aren't in the book. One that came in too late from Shabtai Kohen Rappaport about vegan restaurants. But I saw him in there reading, learning with a Gemara in the restaurant. So he focused on philosophy and the Rambam, but on his free time, he learned Gemara. So I was there with him. It was the year before... Boteach, the 2 years before Shmuley Boteach and Cory Booker. So Norman Lamb comes to spend his time there. And I got to meet him. In fact, I asked him to speak to the Orthodox students. We were having, first of all, we would have dinner every night at the Oxford Shul, and we would daven with them on Shabbos. The problem was the mechitza was low, really low. Women were in the back and it was quite low. And there was a big machokas, and some people were threatening to leave, form their own minyan, but it was a problem because we ate with there. And so Norman Lamb comes, he speaks to the group, and we have, he gives a very nice presentation. He had dinner with us, and then in the question and answer, someone asks him about the machitza. What does he think? And he looks at it and says, you know, it could be a little bigger, but when I went to the Jewish Center, it also was very small. And after I've heard everything that the community does for you, they feed you and everything, I wouldn't make it a big deal about it. Just stick with it for now. And once he said that, that was it. No more dispute. No one was saying anything. So get to the book now. He publishes Torah. the book Torah Mada. And if you look on, well, let me read you what I wrote here. This is my letter. I wrote to him in English also, but this is in Hebrew. So the Hebrew is what I include in the book. He had a little English and the rest is Hebrew. One of the letters to him, he didn't reply. He gave it to J. David Bleich. And this has been quoted a number of times, in particular by Michael Broyd in his book on the legal practice of Jewish law. I wrote to Lamb asking, what's the justification to have a law school? A lot of these lawyers are going to come out and they're going to violate Jewish law by suing people and everything. He gives it to J. David Bleich. J. David Bleich wrote me a 3 or 4 page letter explaining, you know, the justification behind Cardozo and law school from a halachic standpoint. Very interesting. Okay, so I wrote to Dr. Lamb as follows. If you look in his book on page 164, well, before I do this, let me say something first. The Rambam in the Mishnah Torah, you see, Lamb tries to show different models of Torah Umada. Hasidic model, not to say that Hasidim would ever be Torah Mada, but that Hasidim, you know, they have seen holiness even in secular things, the Rambam, etc., etc. Hirsch, Shem Sharaf, Hirsch, Rav Kook. The thing about the Rambam doesn't, you're probably going to think I'm crazy when I tell you this, but it's true. The Rambam does not believe in secular studies. I know everyone goes around saying the Rambam supports secular studies, and people think Shapiro's crazy. Shapiro, what, I'm living in Williamsburg or something, the Rambam doesn't believe in secular studies. But I mean it. The Rambam does not believe in secular studies. The Rambam, he speaks against the study of history. It's a waste of time. Poems. He's not into any of that stuff. The Rambam's into Torah. But for the Rambam, Torah is much broader. If you look at the Mishnah Torah in Sefer Mada, Yesodei HaTorah, that's the beginning of the Mishnah Torah. Yesodei HaTorah is the essence of the Torah. The first four chapters, the Rambam has science and philosophy. And then it says at the end that this is part of Gemara, and this is the essence of the Torah. This is the most important. This is the big stuff. And then the Talmudic disputations, that's small compared to this. The Rambam doesn't believe in secular studies. He has expanded what Torah studies are. Rav Kafach has an article called Limude Chol, in quotation marks, secular studies in the Rambam. The Rambam just has a much broader understanding of what Torah is. And this is not Torah Umada in the sense when we think of, the Rambam didn't believe in Torah Umada. The Rambam believed in Torah, but Mada is Torah. So for instance, I think it's maybe it's mitzvah number 77, I think, you have to love God. How do you love God? Well, who's God that you can love him? You don't know him. So the Rambam explains it's an intellectual love. What does that mean, intellectual love? You understand about science. You understand about the world, the creation. Today, you could say, for example, you learned about the human eye and how that's, and then you're brought into wonder of God's creation. And that brings you to an intellectual love of God. This is part of Torah. And therefore, science is a necessity to fulfill the mitzvah of loving God and to understand so much more. So it's basic. And it's in the Rambam. He doesn't hide this. This is not some one of the secrets of the Maor Nevuchim or anything. It's right there in the Mishnah Torah. So I'm reading Lamb's book on page 164. His Lamb gives a whole exposition and exactly what I'm saying. And then he says, however, do you therefore make Birkas HaTorah for studying organic chemistry? Or equally absurd. I don't know why it's absurd. It's not absurd at all. But he says, equally absurd. Then he says, may you study calculus all day and thereby be exactly exempt from other Talmud Torah that day. I might say it's absurd for a different reason, because calculus doesn't work here. Calculus for the Rambam is sort of like, it's something that's like an appurtenance. It helps you to learn. You study calculus so you can understand Kiddush HaChodesh or things like that. The Rambam never says that the mathematics per se, the Ralbag does, but not the Rambam, will bring you Olam Haba or anything like that. So, but chemistry? And the Rambam, and Lamb says explicitly, no. The Torah blessing is restricted to, quote, texts of Torah and the review, explication, and analysis of those texts. He says, so texts of Torah. What does that mean, texts of Torah? He says that the Pardes, which is all this philosophy, which I mentioned, that's Talmud Torah, but we don't say a bracha on it. He says the study of physics done in the proper manner is an active study of Torah, but requires no blessing. I understand this. So I wrote to him. I wrote to Dr. Lamb, and I said, what's going on here? What's the basis that you say that the Rambam calls this? Here, I'll read it to you. The second here, word for word, what the Rambam says. Just so you know, I'm not making this stuff up. Yesodia Torah, chapter 4, right at the end, after going through all the stuff, he talks about the Pardes, and he says that this, the philosophy I've spoken about, this is Maisa Merkava. And Maisa Merkava, we know that's the most important thing. And what's a Davar Katan? A lesser thing? That's the Havaya Davaya Varava. That's Talmudic argumentation. Only after you study Havaya Davaya Varava, what he says, Leida, to know the Isser, Aser Vamutar, then can you move on to the bigger stuff. How could you not say Birkas Torah? You're studying the essence of Torah. Yesodia Torah. How could, so what, I asked him, what's your basis, Dr. Lam, for this? Because he doesn't, he just says it without explaining it. And he replies to me that I should, he tells me to look in the Gemara in Brachos, and he says, it says there that you say the Birkas Torah on Mikra, Midrash, Mishnah, Talmud. And then he says, based on this, we see that it has to be a text of Torah. I wasn't satisfied, because if you look in Hilchos Talmud Torah, chapter 1, in my book it says chapter 11, it's actually chapter 12, and you have to see different versions divided differently. A section of Talmud, the Rambam includes as part of Talmud, study of the Pardes. He says that explicitly. If you look in Hilchos Talmud Torah, 11, he says you should divide your day into three parts, a third in Torah Shebichtav, a third in Torah Shebaal Peh, and a third in Yaskil Acharit Davar Rishon, understanding, argumentation, etc. And then he says, this is called Talmud. And if you look in number 12 there, he says that that the matters that are called Pardes, and we know what Pardes is. Pardes are all the philosophy he speaks about. Bichah HaTalmud is included as part of Talmud. So that would be explicitly yes. So then Dr. Lam writes back to me, he says no. He says, well, look what the Rambam says in Hilchos Talmud Torah and compare it to what he says in Hilchos Tefillah, where in Hilchos Tefillah, he says that when you get up in the morning before learning Torah, he says, Hamashkin Likros B'Torah, if you get up to read Torah before Kriyat Shema, he says, whether you read Torah Shebichtav or Torah Shebaal Peh, you have to make a bracha. And then, so he says, Torah Shebichtav or Torah Shebaal Peh. And then if you look in, Hilchos Talmud Torah, Perek Aleph, Halacha Yud Aleph, he says, you divide your day three ways, Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebaal Peh, and then as we already saw that to understand the argumentation. But he says, if you look back in Hilchos Tefillah, when he says that you have to make the bracha, he's only referring to the two first parts, Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. That's what you make a bracha on. In other words, you don't, and that's the first two of the way you divide your day, the three. The third part, which is, he calls it, Yavin v'yaskil acharit davar mereshito, v'yotzi davar midavar, v'yidme davar ledavar, v'yadim minus atorah v'dreshes behen, etc., etc. You don't make a birkas atorah. And that thing, that's part, the parties is included. That's his answer. All I can say is, it makes no sense at all to me. Based upon what Rabbi Lam writes, if I sit down for an hour and explain to you an analysis of Svara of the Ketzos HaChoshen, you wouldn't make birkas atorah? Okay, if you read the Ketzos HaChoshen, I think Dr. Lam would also agree you make it, because it's a text of Torah Shelaveh. But how about I just explain to you a Svara? Or how about we sit together, and like my son, God willing, he'll be in yeshiva next year, so they sent out like a shiur. Do you count, is the first, should belief in God be counted as the first mitzvah? That was a shiur they sent out before Shavuos. We could have a whole conversation for an hour, speaking philosophically. Are we saying that that's not part of... that's part of the Pardes. Well, you wouldn't say Birkas HaTorah for that? I think you would. So then how would you explain the Rambam's Lashon? I think it's, he's just saying you get up and you, it's difficult maybe, But he says, you get up and whether you learn Torah Shabbat Tav or Torah Shabbat Peh, maybe over there this is included in Torah Shabbat Peh. I don't know. I see what Rabbi Lamb's point is. On the other hand, the other side is it leads you to this unbelievably, in my mind, strange result that Yesodei HaTorah, which he tells us, which Lamb himself tells us is the essence of Talmud Torah, you wouldn't make a Birkas Torah on it? I don't know. I find it very difficult, even though you have that text in the Rambam that he cites. Okay, that's so. Let me move on to another very interesting thing. So that was my. I had more other dealings with Dr. Lamb. Good conversations with him when I once was in the Upper West Side at the Spanish and Portuguese Synagogue. He honored me by coming to all my classes. We spoke privately, and he told me all sorts of stuff, which at the moment I don't want to reveal it, but he thought it should be revealed. His views on certain issues of the day. And I'm not saying I was close to him at all, but the few times we were together, I learned a great deal, and I was happy to, even though it was a short letter, I was happy to be able to include this in the book. Now, the next letter, number 14, this I need to give you a background as well, because it's from, let me show you his picture here, from a great rabbi. He hasn't been well the last couple of years. Here he is. Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henker. He's the grandson of the great Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, the posek of New York, really the leading posek in New York before Rav Moshe Feinstein. None of Rabbi Henkin's children, whom he sent them all to Yeshiva College, but none of his sons became great Talmudic scholars. One of them became an internationally known lawyer, Louis Henkin. He had a grandson, though. He has a grandson, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henker, who was in America. I believe he went to Flatbush, then he went to Columbia, and he's been in Israel now for many years. The father of Eitam Henker, who we mentioned in previous class, a very, very big Talmud Chacham, author of four volumes, responsa called B'nei Vanim. Interesting questions. He's one of the poskim in the modern Orthodox orbit, answering questions from the non-Orthodox world. And he himself is in that orbit. His wife started the school Nishmat. The whole idea of Yuetzet comes out of them, and he was the halachic advisor, the halachic authority behind this. One thing I can say, and I did say this to his wife, I never told him personally, we used to communicate a good deal. He used to read my blog posts and send me information on them. But the real problem with his sefer, you take a look at Rav Moshe Feinstein's Igros Moshe. Very important work. You can chart the history to a certain extent of American Orthodoxy from his work, because you see who he's writing to, you see the problems. And this could also even have halachic significance. And Ramosha writes an answer to Berkeley, California, as he does to the Chabad House in Berkeley. The answer, when you see the answer given there, well, you know, had he been writing to Muncie or Brooklyn, it might be a completely different answer. So it's important for a variety of reasons to know who the letters are being written to. Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henker never tells you who he writes to. He writes Lichvod and then just leaves the name out. So you have no idea. And that I don't like that. You know, we learn as people who study the history of halacha and responsa, you learn a great deal about who is in correspondence. And when you see, for instance, that a really right-wing rabbi is corresponding with a left-wing or Hasidic with an anti-Zionist or an anti-Zionist with a Zionist, it's interesting. I have a number of letters from Rabbi Henker. The one we're going to speak to about now is... it's not the most famous. Two of these letters became very famous. The other one we'll speak about is quoted all over the place, and no one knows who he wrote to. Now they do. This is titled Aliyah Kofer LaTorah B'Shat Hadchak. Can you call up a heretic and give a heretic an aliyah in an emergency situation? What is it? What's a heretic? What's an emergency situation? Well, before we get to that, let me tell you. I have to tell you a little bit about the history here and what's the background of this teshuvah. I mentioned already that I was a student at Brandeis University, and then I worked there. So I come to Brandeis University in 1985. Brandeis, for at least 15 years had had what you call an orthodox advisor, namely someone who hired by the Hillel to minister to the orthodox students. What that meant was he would come, and it was always a he, even though they weren't necessarily rabbis. Most of them were not. They'd come on Shabbos every other week. They'd give a shiur. They'd run the minyan, that sort of thing. Marty Lakshin, who spoke for Torah Motion, served in that role briefly in the 70s. I think Howard Kreisel served in that role. Rod Glojauer, Moshe Simkovich, a number of people. Many of them were graduate students, and they were doing this on the side to make some money. The Hillel was run by a man named Rabbi Albert Axelrod. He's alive today. I want to show you his picture. This is how what he looked like when I went there. He was a Reform rabbi, graduate of Flatbush, by the way, Reform rabbi, a well-known peace activist on the left. He had the distinction of Marvin Antleman, if the name means anything to you, rented a hotel room outside of Boston, him and two other people, and they put the entire New Jewish Agenda, Noam Chomsky, and Albert Axelrod in Cheirim at the same time. They did a whole ceremony with a shofar and candles and the whole bit, and he was very proud of Rabbi Axelrod. Now, Rabbi Axelrod was a wonderful man. I knew him as a student, and I knew him having worked there, as we'll see. The problem was that he was a Reform rabbi, and he was really Reformed. He did intermarriages in the 80s. Most Reform rabbis didn't do intermarriages in those days. And for the Orthodox students coming off a year of Israel, seeing Rabbi Axelrod, they didn't know what to make of this. And there was a lot of negative feelings. When I tell you that but he did so much, and we'll see, behind the scenes to help the Orthodox student body. Just to give you an example of why I say he really was a wonderful person. And I'll read more of these later. I want to read you something. I'm embarrassed to read it, but I'll read it anyway. I'm embarrassed because, you know, you write things when you're young. It's from 1987. I believe it or not, I won an award from the Hebrew Union College. They had an essay contest, and I about the situation in Israel, religious, non-religious, and I wrote an essay, and I won it. And the prize was to go to Israel for the summer and take classes at the Hebrew Union College there. And I wasn't interested. I turned it down. What am I going to do at the Hebrew Union College? In fact, the guy calls me up, tries to convince me to go. He says, "Do you know how many thousands of dollars you're giving up here?" Whatever. But I didn't. What am I going to do in the Hebrew Union College? But so it's on my CV that I'm the Hebrew Union College award winner. Rabbi Axelrod, at the time, we didn't know each other. He wrote me a letter because he must have got the news that, you know, a Brandeis student has it. I was actually going to England, but this was right before my junior year. He writes me asking me if I could, you know, how proud he is, and do I plan on becoming more involved with the Reform Minyan? You know, because he's never seen me in 2 years, so. I write as follows to him. It's a terrible thing. I'm not happy. I'm not proud of what I wrote. I wrote it because he always said, and I heard from people, he always wanted you to tell the truth, what you thought. He debated Meir Kahana. The Orthodox students, he wanted them, you know, they'd write these things to him in the newspaper, and he'd be, "Good, I want to hear what you think." So I figured I'd write to him, but I'm embarrassed because what do I need? Like I said, Agudas Yisrael will give me an award, but what I wrote is, let me just... Concerning becoming more involved with the Reform group, I have to decline. I say that I support full freedom for Reform Jews in Israel, but I fully agree with the Rav's position. A synagogue without a machitza is unfit for prayer. I go on to say I don't believe that conservative synagogues with Christian eyes, but from day one, Reform has adopted an approach geared to coming more into line with Christianity. How else explain certain great Reform leaders' desire to move Shabbat to Sunday, the confirmation ceremony, the bearing of heads? Those Reform tendencies, which are not geared to Christianity, are geared to secularism, which Reform calls modernity. I go on and on, blasting Reform, and then say, you know, I know you like to hear the truth, so here I am. So what? It's a lot of chutzpah. I mean, he's inviting, he's thanking me, you know, he's congratulating me, and I didn't need to, but you know, you go to Israel sometimes, they turn you into a bit of a kanai. I go on to say how the future of Reform is just like the Karaites. It'll become a sect like the Karaites, for that is the fate of all who abandon the Torah. Really tough stuff, like I said. And to his credit, despite that, and despite another thing, I wrote him another letter attacking him. He wrote a thing on conscientious objection. I told him how crazy this is. He still would hire me a few years later as the Orthodox advisor. So, I mean, I have such respect for the man, and you'll hear later on. So how did I become the Orthodox advisor, though? Okay. The junior year, I was not there. I was in Oxford. The following happened. I would come back, though. When I came back, they do trimesters. So I came back, and then I went up to Brandeis, so I knew what was going on. And I knew the person, the Orthodox advisor, who this was involved with, but I was not there the weekend it happened. We got a new Orthodox advisor. The first year I was there was Rabbi Lazarus from Framingham, Massachusetts. He's a Chabad rabbi, very interesting, nice. Then we had Rabbi Mark Gopin, my sophomore year. So junior year is a YU guy, to the right. And he decided that he's not going to give Rabbi Axelrod an aliyah. Now Rabbi Axelrod would come once a year to the Orthodox service. He's the one that gave the money to pay for the Orthodox. He didn't have to do this, to pay for the Orthodox advisor. He's the one that came up with the money for the Erev. You know, he did all these things, which, and many more, which I later learned that he didn't need to do. He could have done things, you know, just basic. Let's say he ran the Hillel, so he could have made a decision that we don't need to do this. He actually encouraged an Orthodox minion, maybe because he was nostalgic for his youth or whatever it was. And he would come once a year. And he would always get an aliyah, and no one ever thought anything of it. So the new rabbi we have tells the gabbai, don't give him an aliyah. Can't give him an aliyah because he's not a heretic. He's not Bikaris. And really, he is not Bikaris because he went to Flatbush. He knows. Most Reformed rabbis don't know anything. He knows. But how could you not give him an aliyah? But on the other hand, the rabbi says, yeah, you have to listen to the rabbi. We always listen to the rabbi. And I was a freshman. The Chabad rabbi told us we couldn't carry the Torah around the women's side. We always would carry the Torah around the women's side. So what did the students? The students revolted. They couldn't carry it around if the rabbi said not to. Instead, we didn't carry it. So we took the Torah out, and we stood at the Ark, and, you know, Mizmar Ladovid, and, you know, we stood there, and we took it out. Hallelujah, we just stood there. That was our little protest. So you have to listen to the rabbi. So he didn't give him an aliyah. And then this becomes a big, Rabbi Axelrod sees what's going on. People were saying, I guess Rabbi Axelrod, it's not us, it's this. And he comes over and he made it worse with the rabbi. He says, if you observe two Shabbases in a row, I personally will call you up. And Rabbi Axelrod replied back, you know, my relationship with the Ribono Sholem is between him and me, you know, not, and it becomes a fighting match. And the rabbi said something he shouldn't have said. He said that Rabbi Axelrod had recently had a heart attack. A young guy. Now he's in his 80s, so he was young then. He said, the heart attack you had, God was sending you a message. So, needless to say, that Motzei Shabbos, the Orthodox advisor is fired. He didn't go away, though. He was fired, but he didn't go away. He remained on campus, and he tried to get the students. He wanted us to create a real Austritzgemeinde, like in Germany. He said that we'll create a separatist Orthodox community, totally independent from Hillel, and he had lined up the money, he told us, from New York to fund this. You can only imagine, he probably went to these rich Orthodox machers in New York and said that a Reform rabbi is persecuting the Orthodox students and we need to create a separate community. And so it was a total separate community, and the students wanted nothing of it. And then there wasn't, for the rest of the 11th, the rest of that year, there wasn't, this was my senior year. I'm sorry, but I wasn't there at Shabbos. There wasn't any Orthodox advisor. Yeah, it was my senior year, but I was not in there at Shabbos. Then the next year, they had Aryeh Cohen for a period, I don't know how many months, and then he didn't last. And then there was a complete year without any Orthodox advisor. And then they called me if I wanted to run the minyan. And the problem was, obviously, and this was explicitly asked to me beforehand, would I give Rabbi Axelrod an aliyah? So there we get the question. And understand what this means. There hasn't been an Orthodox advisor now for about a year and a half. There's no guidance for the students. And so you have, but you have Ramosha Feinstein's tshuva that you can't. So I still need to tell a little bit, two or three more minutes of background we can do next class. I need to tell you how the one time, actually let's stay two more minutes since we're on a topic, and next week we can go right into halacha, what Rebbe Henkin said. So when the whole thing broke apart, and Rabbi Seiden, I don't want to say his name, I said it, okay, sorry, was let go. People started calling different rabbis. Someone actually called Chaim Soloveitchik and asked Chaim Soloveitchik, what would the Rav say? Could we give him an aliyah, relax, or an aliyah or not? And Chaim said, well, you know, my father used to give a reform rabbi an aliyah, but this wasn't really a reform rabbi. It was a conservative rabbi in a reform shul, and he used to give a lot of money to right-wing yeshiva, so it's different. So he, of course, didn't want to give us an answer. So I had, then was stuck with the problem, what to do. And I would turn to Rabbi Henkin, and we'll see how he replies and the different modalities and the problems that come up. I do want to say, though, that there was a time that Rabbi Axelrod did break his model of always supporting the Orthodox community. And as I said, he did it, and you'll hear more stuff behind the scenes. I only have the best feelings for him. But there's one more event I'll tell you, and I'm telling you this, I wrote about some of this in the Sfarim, Bob, but it's also good to get it on the record. And this was when, we'll take 5 more minutes, and then I'll take the questions, when a certain personality came to speak at Brandeis. Brandeis was a very like pluralistic type of place that we each would have our own minyanim, but then we would come together for the meal. And that's going to be relevant for another tshuva of Rabbi Henkin about a woman saying Kiddush. But then we'd go for an oneg Friday night. And everything was done al pi halacha, even if let's say the Reform were sponsoring the oneg, you know, some speaker, nothing, no violation of Shabbos. When I was working there already, Rabbi Axelrod calls me in and we have a meeting, him, me, and the conservative rabbi. They have a chance to get Dr. Ruth Westheimer to come speak. For the young people, you might not remember, Dr. Ruth Westheimer, she became known as a sex therapist on the TV, on the radio. If you grew up in New Jersey, you remember her, I think it was WOR. I remember because I think it was in 1983. When I was a junior, all of a sudden, I never heard of her. My school, JEC, sends home a letter to all the parents, no, the Buria, the girls' school, to all the girls, that the mothers should not let their daughters listen to this. Now, of course, most of us have never heard of this, but as soon as you send home a letter telling them not to, if you can imagine what they're doing next Sunday night, everyone's wondering what's like the proverbs say, you know, if it's forbidden, it's sweeter. And then, so then everyone knows. And how can you prevent the kid from listening to the radio? And it was the whole novelty of this, you know, this older woman. She wasn't so old. She's, I think, 56 then. But we thought she was some old timer, and she's speaking about all this sort of stuff. I'm sure you can find it on YouTube. But she's someone who grew up in a traditional Jewish home. She went to Israel, and she was going to come speak at Brandeis Friday night on her experience of growing up Jewish in Germany. Someone was sponsoring it, and it had to be Friday night. And the problem was that Dr. Ruth said she couldn't speak unless she had a microphone, because her voice was low. So Rabbi Axelrod, I think he brought us together to tell me, not to really discuss, but he wanted to discuss, can we have a microphone? And I said, of course you can't have a microphone. You know, we're not at Union College. If there's no Shomer Shabbos kids, you all can do what they want. But I mean, this is the status quo here. You can't have an event if there's a microphone. But then he turned to the conservative rabbi, and she never would cross me. But he asked her, what do you think? And she said, well, you know, we use a microphone in shul. So obviously, what kind of question is it? So I said, okay, well, we're going to have it. And I said, well, then the Orthodox can't come. We've never, ever boycotted. We never not come. And I think it's a terrible thing. You're putting an event that we in the Orthodox community can't go to, but whatever. So I made an announcement that the Orthodox community, I'm not speaking strict halacha. Maybe you can make a case. You're sitting in the first row. You can hear her without the microphone. It's just, you can't go to an event which is, you know, violating Shabbos like this by a Jewish organization. So I make the announcement Friday night that, you know, this is my opinion, that we none of us should go. And as I guess 50% of the students didn't go. And for a non-Orthodox rabbi, I guess that's doing okay. You know, 50% listen to you, you're doing okay. So in that sense, Rabbi Axelrod, I think he made a mistake on that. But this is the interesting story, end of the story. We're sitting down at the meal, soon it's benching time, and who comes into the dining room asking where I am? She obviously had heard that the Orthodox students weren't coming, Dr. Ruth. She comes and she sits down next to me, and she's unbelievably apologetic, saying that, you know, she didn't want to hurt our feelings or do anything against. She also knows what Torah is, she grew up, and that she can't speak without a microphone. She sat with us, she benched with us. I mean, it's funny, she benched, she didn't wash, and she didn't eat bread, but she benched with us, and she said she remembered that tune, Baruch Atah Hashem, from her youth. I don't know if she meant in Israel or in Germany, and she was very apologetic. So now that we've set the stage, you have a Reform rabbi who clearly from the standard of halacha is a kofer. On the other hand, someone who has done unbelievable stuff to help the community. And also the flip side is that you're not going to be able to appoint an Orthodox advisor unless he agrees to give an aliyah. At least that's what I was told at the time, and that was the case at the time. I was succeeded by Rabbi Aryeh Klepper, and he told me he never gave him an aliyah and it wasn't a problem. But at my time, this was actually a question that was asked. I turned to Rabbi Yehudarzal Henkin. Why Rabbi Henkin, not Rabbi Greenblatt, others? Because Rabbi Henkin is someone who had been on a secular university. I thought he would have a sense of what's going on. Is that looking for a heter? I guess you can say to a certain extent. But is there anything wrong with that? We'll talk later on in a future class. Is there anything wrong with that? There's a whole chew from Rabbi Ratzabi on that. So I went a little bit over, so we will stop now. We've set the stage. Boy, I didn't think we'd one class, only one tshuva, one and a half. But what can we say? It's Rabbi Tarfon says the work is for us to do. We don't necessarily have to finish. But stay tuned for next week, Rabbi Yehudarzal Henkin, the first of his groundbreaking tshuva to me on these sort of modern cultural issues. Let me now take a few of the questions and comments. So Alan says Avdo, it's a Kamatz Katan. Okay. But Etchem is not, so that's a good example. It's not a Kamatz Katan. You're saying it's Kamatz Reyer Kamatz. Okay. So then I take that back. So Yair says he passed away, the person whose picture I showed you before. Very interesting. Susanna Levin says it's amazing they printed that. Well, when you say they printed it, it's not amazing. Because the students did it, and yes, there's supposed to be someone who oversees it, but who knows how carefully they look. What's amazing is the students. It's the student change, because when I went to high school, they wouldn't have allowed that in either, but the students wouldn't have cared. So you see the type of student and how Torah Vidas has changed. I encourage Shinus says Rabbi Dopkin died in 2008. The Force Tagada. Unbelievable, Mel says. So I encourage everyone to go look. I downloaded all the yearbooks. Because who knows what other interesting things there are in the yearbooks. Maybe some of them mock some of the rabbis. Who knows? Kay Shiner says that in Rabbi Lichtenstein's speech at the centennial, he proudly mentioned the influence of his father and grandfather on him. So then I wonder why the book, sometimes they're more pious than the Pope. The book is a good book, though. The pictures are unbelievable, and they do tell the history, the founding of Torah Vadas authentically. They don't cover up Rabbi Zev Gold or anything else. They mention Mizrahi. But at the end of the book, where they mention appointing him, I mean, Ravi Reuven Grzovsky was involved with Torah Vadas, sure. He was Rosh Shiva there, but his wife's grandfather, I mean, and not to mention, it's unbelievable. So David gives the link there, a treasure trove. Jack says the Malachim had a shul in Williamsburg in 1560. Don't know if it's still there. There still are Malachim. So I imagine they still have a shul. Many of you might recall when the Satmar in the 70s burnt the Rebbe in effigy. It actually wasn't the Satmars, it was the Malachim. But the Malachim sort of like hang out and are with the Satmars. So people, if you look at Jerome Mintz's book, Hasidic People, his whole chapter on the Malachim, they're attached to the Satmar and they put the Rebbe up on the thing and they burnt him. That had significance to the Scranton Jewish community because the Scranton Jewish community used to have a very small shechita by the Fink family, my former landlords. And I was once told the story by David Fink, how they became so big. What happened was until the burning of the effigy, Chabad would buy all their chickens from under Satmar Hashkacha. But after this happened, and after Satmar did not base them, did not condemn it or anything like that, they then needed to find a new chicken manufacturer, new Ashgacha. And lo and behold, that's when David Fink, Fink's Poultry out of Scranton, which is basically the exclusive, you know, Chabad poultry, they, Crown Heights Ashgacha, then puts it on David Elliott Poultry. And it's history. Then that's the history of how it became so big and it became the Chabad chickens. If you know David Elliott Poultry, I heard this from David Fink myself. David Fink, when I knew him, I lived in Scranton. David lived across the street from me, and he had just remarried. His second wife was Rabbi Louis Bernstein's widow. David, thank you for giving us Rabbi Lamb's The Links. In addition to the homiletics, they include a great historical review of contemporary events. Yes, indeed. Chaim Maltz tells us that Rabbi Yaakov Shor, Yudai Shor's brother, became the leader of the Malachim. So I guess through that Tarvadas influence. Someone says, explain the connection between sex and praying. Who said that? Well, let's just say it's the movement. And if you look at it, the similar looking movement. This was said by which one of the Hasidic teachers? Here it is. It's in Likutei Mikarim. This includes writings of a number of Hasidic masters. I in one of my Svarimbach posts, I actually included a picture of this. I can send it to you. Kainer, K. Scheiner, or Keffet has a lecture about the battle to become YU's president. I'm sure he does. The problem is we don't have the inside scoop. All we have are stories. I've heard the same stories. I heard stories from Rackman. Rackman wanted me to write his autobiography, write his biography. He was going to actually pay me a lot of money. It broke down because he wanted to have final say. He wanted to read all the chapters and have comments. And I said, I can't do that. If I'm going to write it, it's going to be an actual real biography. Because the story is a very interesting story, Rackman. So I interviewed him, and from his perspective, he told me the Rav supported him. And he said, you could ask Tversky. And Isidore Tversky would acknowledge that. I don't believe that for a minute. And we know that the Rav, he publicly attacked Rackman's position. Although I don't know if his publicly attacking Rackman's position on the Tavel Meitav Tandu was before or after. I think it might have been after this. I don't know the year. No, it was before. But be that as it may, it wasn't the only time he attacked him. He attacked him ideas of his at other times as well. So I find that difficult to imagine. But Lamb was young and inexperienced in terms of running an institution, whereas Rackman had been assistant to the president. So I don't know. What we don't have, and what Gurak's book does not do, is really interview people and get to the bottom line. What was the debate? Why did they decide to go to Lamb? Why, what were they afraid of going to Rackman? Rackman had all this experience, and Rackman was like the closest friend to Samuel Belkin. So that we don't have really an inside story. There was a student representative on this who told me what he remembers from it. David says the Dor Rivi says the only difference in Torah and science is that science was given to all humanity, but Torah was only given to Israel. That's interesting. Is that in the introduction, David, to the Dor Rivi? Okay, were Rav Henkin's sons religious? Yeah, they were religious. But not modern Orthodox, I guess you could say. Did Rav Henkin have any daughters? I don't believe so. Someone asked me privately, did Rabbi Lamb ever speak to me about my book, The Limits of Orthodox Theology? Actually, since you ask, I'll say it. I don't want to say it because he made a very harsh comment about certain Rosh Hashiva and something. And I changed something was in the book in the second edition to be softer. And he said I shouldn't have changed it. He said, I should have kept what, if you could figure it out, you could figure it out. If not, so we did discuss that aspect. He told me I made a mistake in trying to change a harsh comment I made there. Mel says, the law professor was, and of course, Rabbi Eitan Henkin's father was religious, and Rav Eitan Henkin's grandfather, Rav Yurtz Henkin's father. There was one who died young, one of the sons. Rabbi Nate Henkin, exactly. Yes, they all were religious. I know someone who emailed me privately. I know about Hamayan. I know about the connection. Mordechai Breuer was very close to Herman Merkin. He used to stay with him when he went there. Scheiner tells us from Henkin's father, Hillel was a teacher in Jewish school in New Haven, et cetera, et cetera. Common Scheiner says, a third son of Rabbi Henkin died as a teenager, is buried next to his father, a few rows behind Heschel, age of Rabbi Meshul Heschel. I gave a picture in one of my Svarimbach posts of this son. Anything else? Was he religious while at JTS? I'm not sure where that is. Zahav says, Dr. Ruth was pre-1948 in the Jewish resistance. Yes. Undoubtedly, Rav Axelrod received Aliyah over the years. There were no previous advisors who gave him Aliyah. Every advisor gave him Aliyah. Now, you take Rabbi Lazarus, the Chabad rabbi, or maybe Chabad's not a good example, he's Chabad, or any of them. It doesn't mean that they came, Rabbi Axelrod might have come on a weekend, they weren't there, but everyone gave him an Aliyah. It was an unbelievable shock. And the Orthodox advisor, he never asked anyone, as far as I know. Maybe he did ask someone, but he went about it all wrong. If he was going to do that, this is something you have to tell the Orthodox minion ahead of time. You need to tell them there might be an issue. You can't just tell the gabbai on the spot not to give him an aliyah. Wasn't the final torpedo in Rackman's candidacy the Rav's direct repudiation? Yeah. Does anyone remember what year that was? Can type it in. I could find it very easily, but...
I believe that was 75, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, the problem is 75 is when Lamb becomes president, so I'm not sure.
It was the ICA convention. The Rav attacked the Republic.
Yeah. Democratic. But I don't know if that's before or after the presidency. But he had made comments. Rackman had come out with some liberal ideas. And so I'm not sure about that, if that's I think it was before. I don't know, Hyman. You have to understand something, that the Rav today is not the Rav then. The fact that the Rav opposed someone doesn't mean he becomes president. The Rav, for instance, was very opposed to changing the charter of YU. But the Rav was a hired employee as a Rosh Yeshiva. It's not like today. There was a number of Rosh Yeshiva. The Rav was the most distinguished, but the board wasn't asking the Rav what to do. The board was making their own decisions. And the Rav's and the fact that the Rav had a disagreement on Hashkafic matter, when Chaim came in and started reading things, supposedly they say, out of one man's Judaism of Rackman, and said this could be a problem, that would have more influence. The fact that the Rav, I asked Chaim Soloveitchik himself, this I've never told anyone, but I'll say it publicly now, I don't think Chaim would be upset. The Rav's position is an unusual position. I mean, why is this chazak any different than any other chazak? In fact, one place the Rav speaks of other chazakas like this as well. I asked Chaim, why did the Rav, what was the Rav's thinking on this? And Chaim himself says he doesn't know, he doesn't understand. Why should this chazak be different than anyone else? Rav Yashiv in one place actually says about Tavu Meitav Tandu, basically says that it's no different, it could change. And we have others who say that. I think the Dor Ravi, in fact, says it in the Tshuva. So the fact that the Rav attacked Rabbi Rackman for some... thing that no one on the board would even understand. And if they did understand it, they might think it's a halachic debate. Rav Moshe seems to agree with Rackman in Tshuvos. So I don't think, it's not today the Rav is, I mean, the Rav could not determine who the president was going to be. The Rav wanted to be president once, but he could not determine who the president was going to be in that area. And even after that, the Rav still was very friendly to Rackman. He said to Rackman I look at matters, what do you say, metahalachically, you look at halachically or something. He never turned against Rackman other than sharply criticized. Even someone who was way much more to the left, Yitz Greenberg. The Rav obviously didn't believe in Yitz Greenberg's ideas. He never turned on him, and he refused to publicly condemn him. And he never would condemn Yitz Greenberg. And so the Rav, I wouldn't say that. Jack says in the Educational Alliance in the Lower East Side in the 50s, there would be a speakers program Friday nights. The speakers often use a microphone. Many from people, even Hasim, if you recall correctly, attended. There was usually a question and answer session afterwards. The firm attendees would have ever asked the speaker not to use the microphone for his response if they wanted to ask a question, and they would only ask questions if the speaker agreed. Okay, that's interesting. Although there weren't any rabbis there, and I don't know if they would ask a shaila if you can go. And maybe halachically, if you're halachically, there's not a problem at all. Because they're doing it anyway, they're speaking in. But this, of course, was a different. This was a slap in the face to the Orthodox community. Every single Hillel event since the beginning of time would have, there wouldn't be any Hillel Shabbos. And to say now we're going to start any Hillel Shabbos, what are they going to do next time? They're going to have the food at the Oneg is not going to be kosher. By the way, since I mentioned Yitz Greenberg was the Hillel advisor, not the one directly before Al Axelrod, but 1957, he was the Hillel advisor. He's the one that made the cafeteria kosher. I mean, they called it kosher, but it really wasn't kosher. They didn't have pork or anything, but there wasn't, no one was watching, no mashkiach or anything. So Yitz Greenberg gets the credit for that. Didn't JTS act as a sort of finishing school for Orthodox rabbis? in the 1930s and 40s, and 40s in particular, most JTS Mosmachim came out of Yeshiva College. That is a fact. And that went on into the 50s also. Per Alan Brill, the popular nigun for not Birchat HaMazon, it should be Birkat HaMazon, was commissioned by Rav Mordechai Kaplan for the Amida. I did not know that. Interesting. Someone asked, did Rav Moshe respect the halachic teachings of Rav Henkin? Very much so. Rav Henkin was one of the few people that Rav Moshe would consult if he had halachic questions. Of course, they were neighbors, so it was easy. They had a huge machlokas over the status of civil marriage, but that did not affect even in the slightest their regard for each other. And the difference, of course, is that Rav Moshe became a national and then an international posek. Rav Henkin never was an international posek in the sense that people, let's say, in South Africa would be writing, asking questions, that sort of thing. So someone says that the lecture was given in 75, a year before he became a viable candidacy. Okay, so we see that the Rav attacked Rakhman's position before the presidency. Thank you very much. And finally, someone asked me about the recently published Tshuvos, two volumes, Gevuros Eliyahu of Rav Yosef Yehudkin. Any censorship? Are the footnotes clearly? There is no censorship, as far as I know. I don't think there could have been. He worked very closely with Eitam Henkin. Even though he's from the Haredi world, he worked very closely with Eitam Henkin. Eitam Henkin never would have allowed any censorship. It has lots of good stuff, unpublished stuff, as well as stuff from various journals. The best part of it, which I sent to Rav Mazuz, and then he quoted it in one of his Motzei Shabbos talks, Rabbi Henkin writes about, even though he obviously comes from the Ashkenazic world, that diktuk is important. We need to know diktuk, and unfortunately, it's not studied. One of the good things, he also, one of the things about Rav Henkin, I don't know why it just popped in my mind, is that he was very much against this practice they used to do in the yeshivas of having a break after Tkiyas HaShofar,
he was very much against having a Kiddush before Tkiyas HaShofar.
Tkiyas HaShofar, which I never understood. We did it in my shul 1 year. And he's very sharp against it. Rabbi Gifter actually writes very sharply to Rabbi Henkin, how could you speak this way against our yeshiva shminhag? This is what all the yeshivas do. And Rav Henkin, and also, I think you got to, in my classes, Rav Henkin, we speak a lot about Rav Henkin. I encourage everyone to listen to it. I love the fact, I don't love Rav Henkin, you know, he writes all about the rent control and this, but I love the fact of Rav Henkin, who was an anti-Zionist, a big anti-Zionist. He didn't believe, he thought it was dangerous. Once the state is declared, then all of a sudden then you have to be a Zionist, in the sense that you have to support the state of Israel. And you have to, sort of like the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Okay, this has been fun. One more question, and I'll end it privately. Someone emailed me, that texted me, that Rabbi Lamb once told him that he was opposed to religious parties in Israel. That's not so crazy. I think Mordechai Breuer was opposed to it. You can have religious, we don't have religious parties in other countries. You can have religious people in the Likud, in the Labor Party. What do you need to have a party whose whole agenda is about religion? Someone texted me privately, Rav Aaron Kohler also attacked Rav Henkin on the Kiddush. That I didn't know that. And thank you all for this. It was very nice. Sorry if I kept you a little late. If those people left, you can come back and listen to the YouTube, and see you all next week. At this rate, we're going to be here a long, long time, but I'm having fun, so I hope